30 years ago, China seemed hopelessly mired in poverty. Mexico had triggered the third world debt crisis, and Brazil suffered under hyperinflation. But in recent decades, these and other developing countries have turned themselves around, while first world nations, battered by economic and fiscal crises, struggled to stay afloat. With the global economy teetering on the brink, perhaps America's prosperity now depends on our ability to learn from these prior former struggles and successes with economic reform. In his new book, Turnaround: Third World Lessons for First World Growth, Dean of NYU's Stern School of Business, Peter Blair Henry, says that there are three things we need for a more prosperous future: discipline, clarity, and trust. It's a great pleasure to welcome Dean Peter Blair Henry to the program. Thank you very much for being with us, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Delighted to be with you.
It is a delight to have you with us. When it comes to this turnaround, at what point did you start to notice this, that this was something that perhaps we could learn from?
It's a great question. It's been a process of actually studying former third world countries, really for well over a decade now. My research is focused on essentially something which is labeled the Washington Consensus back in the 1980s. And the Washington Consensus is basically a set of policy prescriptions that were outlined by former Secretary of the Treasury James A. Baker III in 1985 at the World Bank IMF meeting in Seoul, South Korea. And so for the last really 12 years of my life, I've tried to understand whether the policy reforms recommended essentially under the so-called Washington Consensus actually help or hurt developing countries. And as I studied the impact of these, of making, you know, some of these changes in developing countries, you know, what really struck me as I've done the research is that there are some common threats to country experiences. So if there were 10 original items on that list of what countries need to do, everything from, you know, fiscal discipline to greater openness to free trade. And what I've noticed is that every country has a different path to prosperity. Countries that are successful take different paths, but the common theme that runs between these countries are what I call their experiences are discipline, clarity, and trust. And so just to give a very concrete example, you know, discipline, particularly fiscal discipline, doesn't mean austerity. Discipline means, in the context of fiscal policy, the willingness to save for a rainy day. And a good example of that is a country like Chile. Chile, in contrast to the United States, saved when times were good so that it would have money to spend when times are hard. In 2001, the United States had a fiscal surplus of about $236 billion. And we decided to give that surplus back in the form of tax cuts. Chile, on the other hand, in 2008, when the country was booming, was under great pressure to spend its fiscal surplus. Chile's finance minister at the time, Andrés Velasco, resisted the desire on the population part of the population to have him do that, and was it burned in effigy, in fact. And but he said, no, this is money for a rainy day. And when the financial crisis hit, Chile was able to institute a $4 billion tax cut package to stimulate their economy. So that's an example of what I would call discipline. And I'm happy to give examples of clarity and trust if that's helpful too.
Absolutely. I want to get to those in just a moment. I want to just go back and talk a little bit about your background, because you make this point very early in the book in the introduction about setting aside your background. You note that you spent much of your childhood in the developing world. So witnessing what you have witnessed and then to think in this way really is going against the tide in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, I had my own sort of personal turn, if you will. I mean, growing up in Jamaica in the 1970s was a very difficult time for the country. And when I began studying economics in college, in particular, when I remember taking my first international economics class, and I figured this is going to be the course in which I learn how the International Monetary Fund drove the Jamaican economy into the ground. And so, of course, I came to the subject with my own personal bias. But once you actually start to understand economic models and you begin to understand data and you begin to look at facts, you realize that the story is much more complicated. And so for me, the personal turnaround happened when I began to understand that, in fact, it's not It's not that the International Monetary Fund drove Jamaica into the ground, but there were a series of decisions that were made by Jamaican leadership in the early 1970s that led to very difficult economic times, in spite of the well-meaning intentions of the leaders.
You mentioned discipline a moment ago as one of the things that we need for a more prosperous future. And you also said that you could describe both clarity and trust. Let us go to clarity, because I think it's interesting because you write about this, how we often think of the stock market as a great indicator. And yet since 2007 or so, we can say, well, what are we thinking? But you make the point that this clarity of looking through the lens of their stock exchanges really does help you to get past ideology and learn what is at the core.
Absolutely. So let's take discipline and clarity together and look at how the stock market gives us some insight there. So discipline, as I said, it doesn't mean fiscal austerity. It means a sustained commitment to a pragmatic growth strategy. Discipline means sustained commitment to something that will create value for the future. And clarity means countries turned around when governments were willing to demonstrate a clear commitment to a change of direction. So how do we know that a change of direction is in fact moving the country in a disciplined manner, that is, towards long-term value creation? Well, the answer is to not ask any particular individual, but to ask, if you will, the stock market responds not to whether a decision that's made by a government to change economic policy is good for people on the left or the right. The stock market responds to what's going to create value for the economy as a whole. And so the insight that I had, if you will, was that if we wanted to get past ideology and get past whether economists on the left or on the right said that the so-called Washington consensus was good or bad for developing countries, that the best place to start the conversation would be to add what do people whose personal savings are at stake in the stock market think about the direction in which the government is actually taking the country? Is the policy change a decision to open up to international trade, or a decision to implement policies to reduce inflation, or a decision to open up to international capital flows? Is that perceived as likely to increase growth in the future and to reduce the riskiness of investments in the present? And so the stock market tells us whether policies are expected to create or destroy value. Now, the thing that people will be wondering is, well, yes, imagine that opening of the country to free trade is good for stocks. That's good for people who own capital or shares, but what about workers? And the important thing to understand about this, about the analysis in the book, is that you cannot create prosperity. And this was a key lesson that Jamaica learned in the 1970s, because the government wanted to create more widespread prosperity largely just by redistributing income. But you have to grow the pie in order to increase overall standards of living. And when you make policy changes that lead to value creation, and the stock market thinks policies are going to create value, then you make it less costly for businesses to invest, because you reduce their cost of capital. And as businesses invest more, then that makes workers more productive. And as workers become more productive, their wages rise. And as wages rise, people spend more money. And as people spend more money, then other businesses begin to thrive. And you get more employment creation, and you get a so-called virtuous cycle.
One of the points that you make, of course, is that prosperity for all, if we're all going to prosper in this, that it hinges on whether advanced nations acknowledge what has worked so well for these emerging economies. And that's when we get into this issue of trust, because we, as the advanced nations, have to trust the successes of those emerging economies and ultimately say, yes, what you've done is good, and then give you some stake in the game that is commensurate with your success.
Yeah, so that's exactly right. If you think about it, we're at a point in time where we in advanced nations, having taught a series of lessons to developing countries in the 1980s and early 1990s, are now in a place where a number of those countries have learned those lessons, put them to good use, and are now growing at 5.5% per year, as opposed to the 3.5% per year, which they grew between 1980 and 1994. So these countries are now growing rapidly as a result of having made a number of these changes, not all of the changes under the Washington Consensus, but the discipline changes that were right for them. And as a result, they're growing more quickly. And in fact, they're growing much faster than we are, because advanced nations are now growing. Last year grew at 1.3% per year. Europe, the Eurozone countries, on average, contracted. And so the rapid growth in advanced nations, in developing nations and emerging markets, is critical to pulling the world economy along and creating and providing that momentum that the advanced economies need to get back on track. But the rub is, by the advanced nations not acknowledging, as you say, the progress of developing nations, we run the risk of creating what I call in the book reform fatigue. Basically, policy changes that create more rapid growth for society as a whole. Taking that disciplined path is not an easy path, because it requires leaders to make decisions that are good for the country as a whole, as opposed to what's good for any individual. And so that means someone has to make sacrifice, right? And a good example of that is the tiny country of Barbados that I discuss in my book. But when countries have to make sacrifices, that means that leaders need to be able to sell to their populations why they're doing things. And when leaders in developing nations have to go back to their populations, and we in advanced nations are not making concessions, or not providing the leaders in emerging nations a platform by which to push forward those tough policy choices, we make their job much harder. And so we run the risk of us, frankly, all losing. Because if the emerging nations don't continue to make those tough policy choices, we will all lose, because they'll grow more slowly and we will grow more slowly. So that's why it's critical that we fill what I like to call the trust deficit. We need to show emerging nations that we are willing to do as we say, and not just ask others to do as we say, not as we do.
You mentioned Barbados, and I think that's an interesting example, because as you write in the book of what they went through, it seems as though it's this is all dominoes, isn't it? I mean, one affects the other.
Yes. So Barbados, I like to use the example of Barbados, because Barbados has, despite being a very small country, has many similarities to the Eurozone countries of today. So in 1992, Barbados was on the brink of a terrible financial crisis. They were about to run out of foreign exchange reserves, because they had fixed their exchange rate was fixed to the U.S. dollar. Now, the euro is not fixed to the U.S. dollar, but within the eurozone, if you're Portugal, Italy, or Spain, or Greece, your currency is essentially fixed to Germany, because you have the same currency. And so what that means then is when Germany is productive and you're not, that you're becoming uncompetitive compared to the rest of the world vis-a-vis Germany. And so Barbados was in a situation where it was becoming uncompetitive vis-a-vis the United States. So parallel situation between Barbados 1992 and the Eurozone countries outside of Germany today. And so Barbados had to make a choice. Barbados had to make a decision about how it was going to become a more competitive place. How was it going to begin to be a place that had a lower cost of doing business and to be able to export? And so faced with those difficult circumstances, Barbados was able to convene the leadership of Barbados. The Prime Minister, Erskine Sandiford, got together the private sector, leaders of the private sector, leaders of the unions, and the government. And they were able to agree that wages needed to be cut. Yes, I didn't make a mistake there. A 9% wage cut was agreed to. It was a very difficult choice. People took to the streets and protested over this. But eventually, the leader of the unions relented and said, we need to do this to save the country. And in return, the owners of corporations agreed to share with workers future productivity increases in the form of higher wages, so that future wage increases were tied to shared prosperity. And by making these concessions, getting to yes, reaching a social compact, shared sacrifice, Barbados was able to avoid devaluing the currency, as the IMF wanted them to do, and was able to turn around its economy and begin growing again. And frankly, many countries in Europe today need to take a page out of Arbenz's book and make changes in the labor market that will make them more competitive and allow them to begin to export and grow their economies.
You do, toward the end of the book, I believe, you quote Sir Arthur Lewis in saying that growth does not necessarily make people happier. But as you point out, what it does do is offer a much wider range of choices.
Absolutely. And this is the key point that Arthur Lewis is making, and I wanted to emphasize in this book, is that economics is not ideology. Economics can help us answer the following question. Economics can ask this question: what is the most efficient way to organize our system of production? But economics does not answer the question, how do we want to live our lives? So one society might decide it wants to be more productive than another society, but another society may decide that, you know, in fact, we make the choice to be a little less productive because we like our way of life, we like working less, or we like traditional ways of organizing society, and we don't want to make the trade-offs that are involved, that are needed to grow faster. And so economics has nothing to say, frankly, about those kinds of choices by the body politic about how society should be organized and what kinds of objectives society should try to achieve, whether it should be, you know, whether it wants less income inequality, more income inequality. Those are choices that voters have to make about how they want to organize their societies. What economics can do, and this is Lewis's point, was to say, okay, given how voters, how the electorate decides it wants the kind of values it has in terms of organizing itself, the kind of society we want to have, what's the most efficient way of dealing with our problems of scarce resources that are needed to deliver the kind of life that we want our society to lead? And so economics tells us, how do we use our scarce resources most efficiently? It doesn't tell us how we should distribute those resources. And I think we often make the mistake of conflating the two. And so we mix ideology, or equity, if you will, questions with questions of efficiency. And so economics doesn't, more efficient economies don't necessarily make us happier, but they give us a greater range of choices. And they do deliver more resources for us to deal with whatever set of problems we decide as a society really are our priorities.
The subtitle of the book is Third World Lessons for First World Growth. And it seems in my reading of the book that it could have been how we need to become less arrogant.
I think that's a fair statement. I think that's a very fair statement. And thank you for your close reading of the book. I think it's very hard for us in advanced nations, having been in the driver's seat for so long, and having through, frankly, our hard work and sacrifice over decades past, reached a place of enviable quality of life, to now say there are lessons to be learned from countries that we taught, that even though we are richer than they are, we have higher levels of income than they do, if we want to continue to grow our incomes and increase our overall level of prosperity to help us, again, deal with issues that we've decided as a society that we want to deal with, everything from income inequality to education, then we need to put ourselves not in the role of teacher, but to step back and put ourselves in the role of student and look at countries who have been able to take to heart the lessons that we taught them in the 1980s and early 1990s and say, there is a way to get to yes. In the case of Barbados, reaching social compromise. The case of Chile, to say that discipline doesn't mean fiscal austerity. It means saving for a rainy day. It means putting more trust in the nations that have actually made significant strides, and giving countries like the BRICS a bigger say in the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. All of these things are very hard for us to do because of the position that we occupy. But the point that I make in the book is this is not just a matter of good manners, it's a matter of good business, and it's critical if we want to create more shared prosperity in the future.
The name of the book is Turnaround, Third World Lessons for First World Growth. It is published by Basic Books. Peter Blair Henry, a great honor to have you on the program. I thank you very much for sharing your expertise with us.
It was my privilege. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is Turnaround, Third World Lessons for First World Growth. The book is published by Basic Books. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.